Accession number 15479, reel 3.
Except that the footage that was shown was mostly black and white, and I was seeing it in vivid technicolor. It was quite a sight. During the war, we were always being told that it was forbidden that we kept a diary. But I think quite a few of us kept little notes, if not a proper diary. And after several raids, I thought I would keep a record apart from my logbook, which the details you kept in your logbook were very scrappy. It would be where you'd been, when you took off, when you landed, the length of the flight, your crew named, and the target. Although there's a remarks column in the logbooks, it wasn't our custom to make any remarks. So I kept this little book, and although I'd already done half a dozen trips, I wrote up from the beginning, from memory and from squadron records. And my notes of that first flight, I've written, on this attack, I was second pilot to Flying Officer Dykins. It was his 13th sortie. The target was well marked and easily identified, clear skies, very good visibility, bombed successfully, good photograph obtained. The flak was rather light. Flak, of course, was the word for anti-aircraft fire. Mostly burst in 1,000 feet below us. Landed at base without incident. Now, that raid, we carried one 1,000-pound bomb and 17 incendiary clusters. These were sort of containers holding several hundred incendiary bombs, and there were 17 of these clusters on the aircraft. It took 7 hours 35 minutes. 50 Squadron, by the way, was five group. Bomber Command was made up of two or three groups. I think it was one group, three group, and five group of Bomber Command. And five group was the well, we thought we were the creme de la creme. Quite often they would do raids just five group, whereas most of the other groups would be in conjunction with another group. And there were 250 aircraft on the raid and only two losses. So the next target was that, by the way, was October the 14th, 1944. So the next target was Nuremberg, and this was our first raid, my first raid in command, RAS Line, and the first raid with my own crew. This time we had one 4,000-pound bomb, 14 clusters. That's 13,200 pounds in total. And I've written up our first sortie as a crew, target identified through 5/10 cloud cover. During the war, you'd assess the amount of cloud as tenths, whereas today the meteorological definition is in octas, eighths. So 5/10 would be half cloud cover. Bombed successfully, obtained a good photograph. Bombing rather scattered, but successful on the whole. The flak was rather light and bursting mostly below us. Landed at base without incident. Lots of fires seen. That was over the target, obviously.
What date was that?
That was October the 19th, 1944. It was a five-group operation, 225 aircraft, and again there were two aircraft lost. By this stage in the war, the losses, percentage losses, were lower, whereas it is more or less standard to lose about 5% up until, say, 44, beginning of 44. In 44, and right up to the end of the war, it was more like 2%. And on these two raids, it was less than 1. The next one was October the 23rd, 1944, Flushing. Our first daylight sortie. Target identified through breaks in the cloud and heavy mist. Controller stopped bombing before we did our run. Flak very light. Fired on once by two or three light flak guns. 7 bombs jettisoned in the North Sea. They landed at base without incident. If you didn't drop your bombs over the target, then invariably, on your way back, you'd have to jettison some bombs to get down to landing weight. There's a big difference between the weight that an aircraft's allowed to land at and it can take off at. This is, structural limitation, not just the undercarriage, but the integrity of the whole aircraft. If you were to land overweight, then it might damage wing spars and all sorts of things, you see. So you always had to calculate what your weight was going to be by the time you landed back at base and then decide how much you'd have to jettison to get it down to that weight. And in this case, we jettisoned 7 bombs. The bomb load was 14,000-pound bombs. So we jettisoned half the load to get down to landing weight. That was just a short trip of 3 hours and 25 minutes. We flew out at 1,000 feet and then climbed to be over the target at 5,000 feet. There were only 80 aircraft and 2 were lost. So the percentage lost there was over 2%. October the 28th, stroke 29th, another night bombing attack. This was Bergen. It was an attack on submarine pens. The target was identified through a break in the cloud cover. Very hazy conditions. Bombed successfully. Very few aircraft saw the target and bombed. Light flak, moderate to intense. Diverted to Pocklington. If that sounds a bit Irish, light flak, moderate to intense, there were 2 kinds of anti-aircraft fire. You see, some of it was called light. It would only be effective up to, say, 15,000 feet. And then anything above that was heavy flak. So it was the kind of gun, really, when you say light flak. It was the smaller caliber guns, which didn't fire as high, but it could be moderate, light, moderate, or intense in itself, the volume of it. And in this case, it was moderate to intense. On the way back, we couldn't land back at base because of fog, early morning fog, so we diverted to Pocklington near York. It was a Halifax bomber station, and after 2 hours sleep we took off and landed back at at our own base. We took 12 1,000-pound bombs, and from takeoff at Skellinthorpe back to Pocklington was 6 hours 30 minutes. There were 225 aircraft, and five were lost, one from our squadron. Number five was on November the 16th, and that was Durham. A night attack again. This time there were 1,100 aircraft. 3, 4, 5, and 6 group aircraft. It was my first 1,000-bomber raid. We had 12,000-pound bombs on board. Our engineer was unfit for flying duties, so the flight engineer leader, Flight Lieutenant Nash, came with us. The trip to the target was uneventful. Flak over the target was moderate. We saw two aircraft shot down. We overshot our turning point, and predicted flak got quite close. The return trip was uneventful. My IAS, that's the indicated airspeed indicator, went US for half an hour, unserviceable that is, so we had to fly without airspeed for half an hour, and then probably iced up, but it was all right again by the time we landed at base. But when we came in to land, we had to go over around again, called an overshoot, because the flaps wouldn't go below 20 degrees. So then we had to land the second time with less flap than we needed. Since this write-up, I've been to where was the place Durham? Called? No. What's the records place? Kew. And read up on the various raids I've been and gathered a little bit more information. So I've made secondary notes. They're not contemporary notes. And on this particular raid, I've written up here target identified by red and green TIs. Those are target indicators. Pathfinder forces would go in first and drop these target indicators, which were big flares. And then there'd be a controller flying in a Mosquito. He'd probably fly very low and see how close to the target these markers were, and then he'd call us up on our radios. At this stage it was when we were carrying what was called VHF, very high frequency radios, which the modern day equivalent is FM, I suppose, but this was only just being developed for aircraft. Up until that time, all RT, that is radio telephony, as opposed to WT, which is wireless telegraphy, where you had a wireless operator sending Morse code, the spoken side of it, the RT, was on high frequency, and that was very susceptible to interference. It had a better range, but could be very noisy, especially if there were static conditions, whereas the VHF had a much shorter range, but it was very clear. So then the controller would call us up, and he'd say, bomb the red markers, or bomb the green markers, or bomb 10 seconds short of this marker or that marker, or bomb to the left or the right of it. So our bombs would then be that much closer to the target. What did I say? Target identified by red and green TIs, and visually by the town and the marshalling yards. We could see these visually. The controller was satisfied. One of our squadron The captain's name was Drinkle. Flying officer Drinkle's aircraft had a bomb which went straight through his starboard wing. When a bomb is released from an aircraft, it's got a little propeller in the nose, and this, as soon as it starts descending, would unwind in the slipstream, and that would arm the fuse. Up until that time, it was perfectly safe. You could have hit the nose of the bomb with a hammer and it wouldn't go off. But once that little propeller unwound, it was fused, and once it made contact, it would go off. Now, in this particular case, an aircraft must have released its bombs, but it must have been so close above this chap's aircraft that the little wing, little propellers hadn't unwound, so the bombs went clean through his wing, made a hole on the top of the wing, which was just the size of the bomb. But of course, when he came out of the bottom, it was taking fuel tanks and goodness knows what with it, and there was an enormous hole at the bottom. But he was lucky that the aircraft that released those bombs wasn't so much higher above him to make the bombs live, but they went through without exploding. So he had quite an interesting experience with that. He ordered the crew to abandon the aircraft as petrol from the tank was burning in the slipstream. The tank had been pierced by this bomb and set alight, and the whole wing was on fire. But then it went, he lost control of the aircraft, it went into a spiral dive, and he managed to regain control. He'd already shut down the starboard inner engine, and he managed to restart that at 2,000 feet. And that was, you know, something like 40 minutes after the incident. So he abandoned the order to cancel. He cancelled the order to abandon. And they all landed back at base. I think he got an immediate DFC for that. Raid number 6 on December the 6th, 1944, was at Giessen, G-E-I-S-S-E-N. 12 1,000-pound bombs. Again, a five-group normal. Did I say how many aircraft were lost on the previous one? Oh, 4 out of 1,100. So that wasn't bad. This was an attack on railway sidings. The target was well marked, clear skies, good visibility, very light flak. The rear gunner thought he saw two jet-propelled aircraft 2,000 yards behind us as we left the target. This was something completely new, of course. Jet engines were just coming into the war at this stage. Very poor weather, both ways of the trip, icing, static electricity, and severe bumpiness, mostly cloud flying. And that was 6 hours and 40 minutes. And out of the 270 aircraft, we lost 7. So that was quite heavy losses. December the 11th, trip number 7. The target was the Heimbach Dam. We had 14,000-pound bombs, a five-group attack, 210 aircraft. The attack was on the stepped overflow of the dam. It was probably one of these earth dams, and the overflow was stepped down, and we were actually trying to hit the overflow so as to flood the River Ruhr and enemy troops. Complete 10-tenths cloud cover, the tops of 6,000 feet all the way there, but there were a few clear patches over the target. We bombed successfully. Very small amount of flak, a few miles to port, The cloud cleared over the channel on the return. We had a very good view of the south coast of Kent and Dover. And I remarked, very easy and enjoyable trip. Even so, there were two losses. December the 28th, 1944, trip number 8. The target was shipping in Oslo Fjord. We had 13,000 pound bombs and one 500 pound. Only 26 aircraft. My bomb aimer was sick on this occasion, so I had the bomb aimer leader, as he was called, Flight Lieutenant Price. The trip out, very uneventful, very little cloud, visibility very good. The moon was almost full. We bombed on two runs, made four orbits. No hits observed. Flak very light and inaccurate. No incidents on the return. We landed at base in misty conditions. And out of the 26 aircraft, we lost three. That's way up. It's about 12%. 11%. December the 31st, 1944. This was an army cooperation exercise at Houffalize. It's quite a famous attack, really. It was an early morning one. We had 14 1,000 pound bombs, 156 aircraft of five group, and it was what was called an oboe attack. That was a special radio control type of attack where the lead-in, the pathfinders went out on a radio beam and then dropped their markers on an intersection of another radio beam. My bomb aimer was sick again, so I took Flight Sergeant Johnson. The trip out was uneventful, except for poor weather conditions. We encountered some icing. The target was covered with 10/10 thin strata Q. The markers could only be seen when directly above them. No flak or fighters at our height. We made three runs. G went US on return. G was a navigation equipment we carried on the aircraft. Landed safely at base. I've done some research on this. I've written it up elsewhere. Do you want to stop the recording so that I can...
Just tell me from memory.
I can't from memory. It was something to do with perhaps I'm mixing it up. No, forget
it. Well, don't worry. If you've done research on it, it'll be on record anyway.
Yes. I believe the army were rather chuffed with the whole thing. We made life a little bit easier for them. January the 5th, 1945, our 10th trip, the target was Royan. By this time, the front line was well advanced, but there were little pockets of German resistance where they were holding out, and Royan on the on the French coast and the west coast of France was one of these places where the Germans were determined not to pack in, and so we were sent to try and persuade them to give up. We had one 4,000 pound bomb and 16 500 pounders. a five group normal, 220 aircraft. Again, I took Flight Lieutenant Price, the bombing leader. My bomb airman must have been sick again. A straightforward trip to the target, clear skies, good visibility. The markers were 2 minutes late, so we had to circle, came in and bombed. Three or four scarecrows, these were sort of diversions sent up by the Germans to try and make us think that our aircraft will be being bombed out of the sky. They just sent up something that looked like an aircraft being blown out of the sky just to try and frighten us off. A few aircraft were shot down. We saw them going down. Quite a good effort for, in inverted commas, small pocket of German resistance. I've made a note that the engineer was rather scared. This was a daylight flight, and I've written that the engineer was rather scared. I can't remember. I think it must have been because of the flak. The bombing was well concentrated, a good attack, landed safely at base. And out of the 220, we lost six aircraft. One from our squadron. I believe Royan had to be completely rebuilt after the war as a result of that. January the 7th, 1945, Trip 11, Munich. One 4,000-pounder. And eight incendiary clusters. This was one of our longest raids. We had a full tanks, a five group normal, 210 aircraft. Red Skinner, our bomb aimer, was fit again, so we were a normal crew. Heavy cumulus over the south of England, flew through two fronts over the Channel and France, arrived at the target on time, markers a bit late. Only one heavy flak gun. The target showed up clearly, being snow covered, and the flares still burning. Bombed successfully. Long, tiring run home. We saw the Alps and lakes and towns, which broke the monotony, and landed safely at base. There were five aircraft lost out of the 210. January the 16th, Trip 12, Brooks, the largest oil plant in Germany. At this stage in the war, the Air Ministry, in fact, the government, were trying to get Bomber Command to attack more synthetic oil plants and not bomb so many towns, but Bomber Harris had other ideas, so he was reluctant to reduce his attacks on cities, but this was an oil plant attack. Most of the oil and fuel the Germans could get was synthetic, so it was a strategic